So, this is part of that ongoing journey of pondering. Last week at marriage prep, we get to do marriage prep. Anne and I have been doing marriage prep for years. This is my wife, Anne. And we are hoping shortly to be qualified, but, you know, it takes a long time. And I think we've probably done this, well, many times. And we actually enjoy, really get a lot out of it every time. So this last week, we were considering, the first week we were talking about communication. How do we communicate with one another effectively? Keep that in mind, Joan Allen. And this last week, we were talking about commitment. What does it mean to enter into a commitment? Actually, we would say covenant, but a commitment. What's the implications of that? And we were reading through the marriage vows together. And we were asked to select out of those marriage vows the most significant phrase for us individually. What's the one phrase that stands out for us? And I immediately knew, something that zeroes in on something else. I knew, for me, what was way high in the marriage vows. And it was that one phrase. It's coming. Press a button, see what happens. Okay, well, I'll just tell you that. I will. That's my investment, my ultimate investment in these vows. You know, there are very few legal requirements when it comes to marriage. It needs to be lifelong. It needs to be exclusive. And it needs to be freely chosen. Though other cultures may, we do not recognize or allow a marriage based on coercion. It must be freely chosen. And so for somebody to say, in the face of heavy, weighty, lifelong vows, I will, I choose, is powerful, it's significant. So I want to try and explore this morning the matter of the will, our freedom to choose. Some say you are what you eat. I'm wondering to myself, am I what I will? Am I will? Will I am? Will am I? That's how I got to my title. Am I the sum total of my choices? Oswald Chambers, somebody who I love to read. I get an email from him every day, even though he died many years ago. And he gives me something to think about, and I ponder his wisdom. He's one of the few people, I suppose, in this world who I feel knew God, not just about God. And when it all boils down to it, that's a powerful thing. And he said this, the most profound thing in a person is his will, not sin. The will is the essential element in God's creation of human beings. And God knows that. And someone else knows it too, who we call the Satan, or the adversary, the accuser. He is our enemy. He is God's enemy. And he seeks by every means to distort and foil God's purpose in our lives. And I'm not going to apologize for the fact that I will be mentioning him a few times today. I think that's okay from time to time. Now, I've subtitled this, The War of the World is Won in the Will. And I hope you'll understand why by the time we're done. But I think there is a war on. Anybody who feels like we're in peacetime has missed it. We're not at peace. And it's good that we wake up in the morning understanding that we are in a conflict. That doesn't mean that we get all heavy or depressed. It just means that we put our armor on and we're ready for a fight. So the war of the world is won in the will. Or to paraphrase a well-known saying, where there's a will, there's a war. Some people say where there's a will, there are relatives. But I'd say it's more like where there's a will, there are angels and demons. The war of the world, perhaps surprisingly to me, as I've pondered this, is not fought first and foremost over lands or properties or possessions, though these are fought over fiercely. The war of the world is not even fought primarily over the control of those mechanisms by which societies, institutions, and people are regulated, dominated, or controlled. And I'm thinking of governments, governmental systems, legislative and legal systems, means of law enforcement, and military might. These are all bitterly fought over, and the resulting oppressions know no bounds. And this is a serious part. I feel serious. I feel it's important that we spent 18 hours yesterday in a blissful state of ecstasy here, worshiping Jesus, worshiping the Father, sitting among the Trinity. It was exquisite. And as ever, God's treasure is hidden in a field. And we found treasure. It was beautiful, and I would love to stay there. I think it's important that we do stay there every day. You can't bottle God's river of life and take it away and keep it for another day. You have to be in it every day. And so there's so much that delights my heart, makes me happy. But there are things in this world that make me lose heart at times, or I would lose heart if it wasn't for the Lord. And I read recently this picture that you see up there was taken in the Ukraine in 1932. It was taken at a time which they call it Holodomor. It's Ukrainian for killing by starvation. And as a deliberate policy of the overseeing government of the Ukraine at that time, not the Ukrainian one itself, food was taken away from the peasants, from the ordinary people. It was an abundant harvest in 1932 and 1933, and yet food was taken away. If anybody was found keeping food, storing it away, hiding it, then they were disciplined severely. They were left with nothing. They were left with nothing at all in a land of plenty. And 10 million people starved to death. It's probably the biggest genocide atrocity in modern history. And yet, strangely, it got mainly left out of my history lessons. Maybe I wasn't listening. But it's an appalling thing. And you wonder what would drive anybody to do such a thing. And I think the answer is to break the will of a people so that they will be compliant. And you can do that. You can break a person's will. You can force and coerce a person to do what you want. And that's what military might and governmental dominance is all about. But you won't have their heart. You won't have their choice and their permission. Ooh. So, many examples of enforced oppressions. But none of these are the greatest prize, though they may be seen as a means to the goal. The greatest prize of all, over which the war of the world is ultimately fought, is something that you and I have near to hand, something that you and I have within our grasp, and it's our choice, it's our will, it's our freedom to choose, which is the legal permission to enter into a person's world and change it. Now, here's a quote from Napoleon. Napoleon had some amazing quotes, and whether they were all actually him or attributed to him, who knows and who cares, because the words themselves are powerful. Here's something he said about controls and government. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have founded empires, but on what did we rest the creations of our genius? Upon force. Jesus Christ founded his empire upon love, and at this hour, millions of people would die for him. So one wins by force, and the other without coercion, by the free and willing choice of the subjects. Are you getting the hang of this? Thoughtful? Okay. Well, let's go way back to the beginning. Wind it back. Okay, not quite to the beginning, but just forward slightly. The plan of God from the beginning has this, for me, a cataclysmic weakness. It all stands or falls on this one thing. And who would have put the controls in the hands of a human? Yeah. You know, dangerous. You know, we were singing about God's reckless love. Some people got really offended about that song. Of course, they get offended about everything. But, you know, God doesn't, he's not reckless. I think he's reckless. Look what he did. For goodness sake, to put the whole of his cosmic plan and purpose within the scope of two people's free choice. You know, I think it's powerful. It all stands or falls on the free, unrestricted choice of the individual. So what about the tree, the fruit, the fall scenario? Let's read it quickly. Genesis chapter 3, have you got your Bibles? Got your iPhones, got your iPads, got your dad gadgets, whatever. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say, you must not eat from any tree in the garden? No, the answer is no. The woman said to the serpent, we may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden. Just stop there, Eve, that was fine. And you must not touch it. Oh, you've gone too far now. Or you will die. Satan, you will not surely die. Or in other words, no, you definitely, definitely, that surely bit. You know, I think it's Old English, but it actually means, no way, it's definitely not going to happen. Trust me, it'll be fine. You will not surely die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for getting wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was standing right there, because the serpent addressed them both. He says, for God knows that when you both eat of it, your both eyes will be opened. He was there. She gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. That's enough. Okay, what did he do, this crafty serpent? He planted doubt, he misconstrued, he manipulated words and facts until it wasn't really clear which way was up, which way was down, what was true, what wasn't, what happened, what didn't happen. I'm all a bit confused now. And then he outright lied. You're not going to die. Oh, yes, you're going to die. So here's a couple of questions. Ready? Fingers on the buzzer. Did they freely choose? Yes. Were they deliberately and craftily misled? Did the fact that they were misled negate their free choice or its consequences? Were they able to control or predict the consequences of their choice? Selah. Untold sufferings were the consequences of their simple choice. One moment in the lives of two people. Surely God could have stopped it. This is what I say. I said, no! No! Rewind tape, think of another plan, do something different. This cannot be. We're only up to chapter 3. It was going so well in chapter 2, wasn't it? Chapter 1, chapter 2. Surely God could have stopped it. Yes, he could. And one day he will. He will. So why delay? Because, and this answers so much about our predicament, our personal predicament, our corporate predicament. He could have stopped it, but he delayed. Because he values the freely chosen love above all. The freedom to choose, he sets higher than every other. Think about that. I mean, there's a lot of other good things. Fishies in the sea, and mountain tops, the wind in your face, the sun. There's so many good things. The freely chosen love of a woman or a man. The greatest words in the great consummation marriage which God is now preparing for his son are when the bride will say, yeah, that's the prize that he's playing for. That's the cost that he is willing to pay to hear those two words. Herein lies the exquisite tension on which everything hinges. The war of the world is won in the will. I will, it transpires, is the hinge on which everything turns, ultimately. And yet we are so often sublimely oblivious, carefree, careless. Here's a couple of examples. I'm not going to get through this without mentioning the names, but I'm going to try. Okay, so a very well-known search engine, which has about 70% of the world market at the moment. Other people who provide windows and things. Other people who provide half-bitten fruit. Other, you get the idea. What shall I say about the other one? The other one, like something you can open and read, but it has people's visage in it. Right. Okay. So, have any of you ever come across this before? Tick the box if you accept the conditions. Yeah, Anne has. Let me see your hand. Give you a bit of exercise. Woo, the rest of you haven't got a computer, have you? Tick the box if you accept the conditions. Right. How many hands was that? It was everybody, wasn't it? Okay, how many of you read the conditions? Oh, you guys, she's a lawyer. Stefan, you must be just very thorough. Sometimes, okay, good. Good. I sometimes feel that they, you know, although there's the thing about clarity of speech and everything, I sometimes still feel that they're supposed to be buried in a deep sea, and the very significant, essential part of it is buried deepest of all. That's my cynical self. And I'll tell you why. Because somehow, by accident this week, I came across something called that search engine that rhymes with frugal, but they're not frugal with the way in which they collect our data. And it's called My Activity. Have any of you ever come across My Activity? Same hands. Yes. Good. Well, you'll know something that I didn't know for years and years. I mean, I kind of knew. But that Google's been collecting, I said it. I did it. You would never have guessed otherwise, would you? I've been collecting information about me, interesting information, all kinds of information, information about who I speak to. Information about what I write in my emails, information about what I say in my phone calls, information of audio recording of what I've said when I wasn't aware of it being recorded. Anne and I have had experience, I may have said this before, driving along the car, my phone is in its holster, I'm not touching it, mostly trying hard not to. And we're talking about something, and all of a sudden the phone says, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. So, well, I don't care whether you, it's not, nothing to do with you. What do you mean? Because, you know, the phone is listening for you to say that word, that key word, but that means it's listening. It's listening all the time. And shock of horrors, it's recording it all. Everything, everything. It's recording where I go. You can bring up a map and see where you were 10 years ago. It's recording the apps that I use on my phone and what I'm doing with them. There doesn't seem to be any limit to what it's recording. And I, just out of interest, before I hit delete, which I did, because I wanted, I know they will still keep it, they'll still have it all on file, because, people who gather data never like letting go of it. I can say that personally as somebody involved in data collection. I just don't like, you know, you've worked hard to collect it all, you don't like letting go of it. And I don't think they're going to let go. I think they're going to still have it. But I'm withdrawing my permission. And I'm saying, actually, I think you're getting a lot more out of this than I am. I didn't even know it was there. And it was 2 years ago, 2016, that this was introduced publicly, apparently. Before that, it was hidden, it was covert, or it wasn't clearly explained. And we're in a season where things are beginning to be put out into the open where they can be seen, so that we will say, oh well, okay, whatever. And in doing that, we've given our permission. You see, what Google now has by producing my activity and allowing you to see everything that they are collecting, if you do nothing about it, you have given permission. And it's the permission that is so all important. We drink from the water of life. Every time I buy a cinema ticket, I enter into a contract of sorts with a filmmaker to mess with my mind, saying, I freely choose, I give you permission by sitting here and watching what you've produced. Every time I turn on the TV, voluntarily or without coercion, I am given permission to be impressed by the values of a system that wants to shape the way I think and act and feel. Wind the clock back, 1984, it's a very significant date, but at the time, Colin and I were about to travel to Poland. It was during the communist era, it was during the Iron Curtain. I'd heard all my life about the wickedness of the communist regime enough to make me know it should be feared. And so for me, as a young lad, to be going behind the Iron Curtain felt like a death sentence. I actually literally prepared myself for not coming back again. And you know, that was part of my misconception. But we traveled to Poland. We met with wonderful people there. We were in the homes of some of the people. Some of them we still know and love today. And the TV was on in the corner in this living room. It was just a little black and white TV. And there was some sort of news broadcast going on. And the kids were playing in the corner. And we were just chatting and drinking tea. And I was getting more and more troubled because I knew that what was coming out of there was propaganda. You know, I'm in the communist system now. The television's on. They're doing that wicked thing. Propaganda. And I was really troubled. I said, don't you know this is propaganda? They're trying to shape the way you think. And Ange, who was our host, who many of you know, looked over at me, smiled benevolently as only Ange can, as if I was a five-year-old. He said, the difference is, you don't know they're doing it. And because we're unaware, we freely welcome. So Satan plays for a legal outcome. Satan is a liar. Or the Satan. I should say the Satan. We should call him the Satan because it means the adversary. Like when you're in court, or we could call him the counsel of the prosecution. It's just a longer way of saying it. But counsel of the prosecution was trying to deceive me yesterday. We just say Satan, Satan. He's a liar. He's a deceiver and a manipulator. When he lies, Jesus said, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But he understands the nature of covenant and the legal power of the free choice. He knows that the omnipotent God, against whom he struggles, binds himself by covenant when somebody says, I will. So much I could say there. I just want you to know that whatever you hear this morning is a small portion of what I had to say. This has been a very serious snipping exercise, which has hurt my heart. But I'm trying to stick within half an hour. By every means, the serpent seeks to prevent or divert us from choosing God and choosing good. In fact, if you're on a journey right now, wondering about your maker, I just, you know, it's helpful for you to know that there are those who are opposing that journey. It may seem that you're just doing it on your own, simple, nobody really knows about your thoughts. He seeks by every means to prevent or divert us from choosing God and choosing good, and from rejecting by a deliberate choice what is evil. There's only one thing that is as powerful as saying, I will. What would that be? I don't will. I won't. I do not. No. I refuse. I stand in and saying, I will not accept that. I reject. I renounce. And part of the ancient baptismal vows, which we can see going way back to the first century, and sometimes I think it wouldn't be such a bad thing for us to reintroduce them. We ask the first part, is Jesus Lord? Is it the intention for you to see and act on the basis that Jesus is Lord for the rest of your life? Yes. Then the second question, do you renounce the devil and all of his works? And the baptizee says, yeah, yes, I renounce. That is powerful. It's significant. Saying Jesus is Lord, not just my Lord, Jesus is Lord, is powerful. It's the will to receive his mastery, to receive his government into my life, to acknowledge that he is supreme. That is powerful because he got his treasure, which is your free choice. To say I renounce the devil and his works is also powerful. Saying yes and saying no, giving and withholding permission, it's the exquisite prize. No, this is not right. I don't accept it. Not on my watch. No, I refuse to agree. I withhold my consent. Yes, this is the true and right way. I choose to walk in it. Okay. We're in a church here, we're at a church meeting. Sometimes moms come in with their young kids. So just imagine there's a mom with a young kid coming to church and everyone's standing singing. And the singing comes to an end and everyone sits down and settles down to listen to the preacher. But we, Will I Am, who was standing on his chair so he could get a better view, just quite liked standing on his chair. And just because everyone else was sitting down didn't mean that he had to sit down, he liked standing up. Everybody started looking around and tutting, and a mother started feeling embarrassed, and so she said, William, sit down. No, William, please sit down. No, I like it, I'm standing. William, sit down. She's trying to say it sternly, but also look like an angel. Sublime. Well, he wasn't having it. So finally, what did she do? She grabbed hold of his shirt tail and she pulled him down and she held him down on his seat. And this little black cloud appears over his head and he said, I'm still standing on the inside. So you see, you can force somebody to do something, but to have their free permission is another thing. Imagine if he'd said, because he knew his mom, because he trusted her, because he loved her, he knew that she loved him. She said, honey, would you sit down, please? And he'd say, yeah, I will. That would be different, wouldn't it? Little stories. Satan's great ambition is not ultimately to rule the world. To control its governments and institutions. He does want to do that. It's not his prize. Through these, he could coerce and control. And he works through all these things, wars, oppressions, and violent regimes. But ultimately, these are a means to his great end. His great ambition is to have you choose him. His ambition is worship, to be like God. In Isaiah chapter 14, we read about this elusive king of Babel, also called the Shining One, which is sometimes translated Lucifer. He said, "You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High." This is what drives him. Satan's ultimate goal is to be like God, to receive worship like God, worship that is freely given by deception, manipulation, lies, by all means, but freely. Now, here's a phrase which has got me thinking for, you know, it's just one of those Selah, just, whoa. Are you ready? Okay, hit it, Toby. Is that true? Yesterday, we had 18 hours of worship. So far in my life, I've had 5,115,592-ish hours of worship. The man who likes numbers. Yeah, that's 21,000 days. Filled with the potential to decide. 2 billion seconds or moments, every one of them, the potential and opportunity to govern my choices. One of those moments in Jesus' life is in Matthew chapter 4. It reports again, the devil took him to a very high mountain. You'll like this, Alan. Alan and Joe go to the craziest high mountains like that. I don't think the snake is there. It's just beautiful scenery. God's lovely creation. The devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms, all the governments of the world and their magnificence. He said, "All of this I will give you if you will bow down and worship me." Freely. Jesus said to him, "No, I reject that proposition. I'm disinclined to acquiesce to your request. Away from me. Authority and power over all governments of the world." Think about that. What would you do if you had the means to control every government in this world? Think about it. In exchange for one thing, freely given worship, "I will give you all their authority and splendor. It's been given to me," says Satan, "and I can give it to anyone I want to. If you worship me, it will all be yours." Did he have the legal right and the means to offer authority over all governments of the world to Jesus? Well, Jesus didn't dispute it. Satan considered the latter greater than the former, worth trading all the governments in the world for worship. One of my questions in life these days is, did Satan ever make that offer to anybody else? Or is that the only time? Are there people in this world today who believe legally they have a right to control the destiny of nations because they've given up the prize, because they've signed away their life, they've made a pact with the devil? I think there are. I do. That's for another day. But the war of the world is won in the will. I hope you're beginning to see where I'm heading with this. Many today may not choose the devil. Of course we wouldn't. No! That serpent guy who hisses, I know who he is. I'm going to say no when he comes along. And yet, we still choose his works from time to time, which are designed to lead us slowly, incrementally, almost imperceptibly, away from the path of life. We believe that we've been free, and all the while ignoring the greatest gift within our reach, the power to say no. Paul said to Titus, his son in the faith, "For the grace of God teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live in this world with wisdom, righteousness, and devotion to God." Okay, I'm getting close to the end now. So, exercising our will. The will is exercised in 100 ways every day as we choose where we go, who we listen to, what thoughts we allow or refuse, what we allow our eyes to see and our ears to hear. Job, in a beautiful moment for me, it says, Job says, "I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman." I made a covenant with my eyes. How do you even do that? Okay, eyes, sign on the dotted line. We're going to have a covenant here. I mean, I don't know the mechanisms of that, but he did it. He made a covenant with his eyes not to do things, but to look in a lustful way, to allow his mind to even go there. No, he said no. Oswald Chambers, one more time. "It's in the middle that human choices are made. The beginning and the end remain with God. The decrees of God are birth and death. And in between those limits, man makes his own distress or joy. Choices can be made actively by giving permission, or they can be made passively by omission, by not saying yes or no." Jesus said to the Pharisees, who love to sit on the fence, who love to stand back and point a finger but never get engaged or involved, he said, "He who is not with me is against me." Hedging your bets. There's no neutrality in the kingdom of God. It's a binary kingdom. It's yes or it's no. And if we sit on the fence, if we omit, then by that omission, we're making a choice. I'm looking forward to next week. Anna's going to be coming and sharing with us. Her subject is having the confidence to make a difference. And part of that whole story is learning that we can say yes and we can say no within our own hearts and lives, within our families, but in a wider context as well. We have a voice. We should use it. That's next week. Choosing the will of another. Saying that I will does not necessarily mean that it's a self-will, selfish will, that I'm having everything my own way. It can mean I choose the will of another. At the altar, I will lay down my life for another. When they say I will, they're saying I choose to live my life for the benefit of another. In baptism, the baptizee is saying, I freely choose the will of another, the over-government mastery of another, the choices, the will of another. In another moment, in another garden, the garden of the olive press, Jesus is pressed to the limit. And he cries out, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." And you know, in that moment, in another garden, he took that apple fruit and he spat it out. He said, "I am not going to be self-governing. I choose to be overruled and to eat from the tree of life." That was a choice, the most powerful of all choices, because it led to our redemption. Jesus had a desire or a will to be delivered from what lay immediately ahead. Why? To escape hardship, suffering, to shun the separation from his Father that he knew was coming. We don't know why, what it was that weighed down on his heart. But he chose to place his desire below the will of another. What is it we pray? We prayed it so many times yesterday, and I can never get enough to pray. Our Father, Papa, the one in the over heavens, your name is awesome. I want your kingdom to come, and your will. It's the most powerful prayer. I want, I wish, I choose your will. He likes to hear that. It's the most powerful prayer. It's not an abdication of responsibility, but it's an affirmation of trust in the will and the goodness of another. So we've been given a precious gift of free will to say yes to God and to what is good, noble, and true. To say no to those things that lead away from God and ultimately to evil and harm. My desire for this morning simply is that we'd be aware and we'd be wise and active in the way that we take the moments of our life and use them to choose what is good.